Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. This week's episode is incredibly interesting. Dr. Tom Horton from the College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse joins us for a conversation about plants and mycorrhizal fungi. I know you're probably thinking that this is going to be another conversation about how wonderful it is that forests are sharing with everyone. However, this is not what we're going to talk about today. There are plants out there that are cheating the system by parasitizing mycorrhizal fungi. However, I don't want to waste any more time introducing this, so why don't we just jump right into my conversation with Dr. Horton. I hope you enjoy. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to come on here and discuss some of your research with us.
Yeah, I appreciate the interest.
Now, you're a mycologist, correct?
Yes.
And you obviously are dealing with a very exciting time to be looking at fungi because of the affordability that genetic analysis is now kind of coming into and the new techniques. But what kind of got you into looking at fungi and the way they interact with plants?
Well, so I was doing a master's at San Francisco State and sort of exploring in all sorts of different topics for research. I hadn't honed in on anything, and I took a class in plant ecology and liked the guy.
Always good.
Yeah, as simple as that. And then went in and talked to him, and he had a variety of projects, most of which were less than intriguing to me, but then he had one that wound up being a paper in Canadian Journal of Botany on Arctostaphylus and Douglas fir succession, and he said this has to do with mycorrhizal fungi, and I had a pretty good hobby of finding and eating edible mushrooms.
And you've lived to talk about it.
And I've lived to talk about it. So I had that interest, and when he said I've got this project but no one's interested and I've got money to do it, I was just like, let's stop looking. I think we both just figured it out. And then, you know, I finished my master's, and that was right when the Bruns lab was finishing up the molecular technology for getting at the below ground part. And so I just kind of shifted over to my PhD over to Berkeley across the bay.
Awesome. So it was kind of serendipitous, but a beautiful story that just kind of fell into place for you.
Yep. Yep.
Cool.
It was super, very timely.
Yeah, I like those things. Now, you mentioned mycorrhiza, and that's kind of a big topic these days, and people are really getting into that whole sharing within the forest, kind of feeling this kumbaya situation. But in kind of reviewing your research, it seems like it's not always this beautiful give-and-take symbiosis. There are some plants out there that are cheating the system, and you had mentioned one of them happens to be, there are some orchids doing this.
Right. Those are the mycoheterotrophic and mixotrophic. There's also some that are still producing green parts and photosynthesizing, but not enough for their carbon needs. So they still have to tap into a mycorrhizal network to get the carbon they need.
Now, how does this work with the mycorrhizae? I mean, are they... They're parasites, at least to some extent, right? Are the mycorrhizae, do they fight back? Is this something that is early in its evolution? Or what are you seeing with this kind of interaction?
Great question. what we do know is that the plants should be giving carbon and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're taking carbon from the heterotroph, the fungus. So at first glance, you know, you say, okay, that's got to be a parasite. That is, the plant is a parasite on the fungus.
Right.
And there's some people that will still sort of try to twist it back into a mutualism and say, yeah, but, you know, it's going to benefit the fungus because it's going to, the plant's going to cause the fungus to produce extra root tips as a way of getting extra carbon from the fungus. And then when the plant dies, that fungus has colonize that area in the soil and ends up winning any competition over the long term. Well, I don't really buy that. I do think they're parasites.
Yeah.
Some of the evolutionary theory behind that is pretty strong to suggest they're parasites. That is that, you know, when we get sick, we combat that virus, and that virus then loses unless it can figure out a way to override our resistance.
Right.
And I think all these microheterotrophs have narrow specificity that basically they're only able to trick one or a couple species of fungus, and that to me, again, points to a parasite. Most of the fungi they interact with are basically kicking them off.
Oh, so it's not that they're not trying, for instance, it's just an incompatibility, some sort of immune response on the fungal part, I guess, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. We don't have, you know, it's still rather theoretical. So ideally we would be able to get in and know what genes are being turned on and off and et cetera. And we're getting there, but not in the microheterotrophic system. I haven't seen any papers yet that looked at that.
Right.
So, but yeah, I think that's the case. There's some anatomical evidence too, where in an orchid, are you familiar with the root anatomy on these guys?
Somewhat. You know, there's the vellum surrounding an interior actual root, but they have that kind of spongy material. I don't know if that's the case for terrestrials though.
It is. Depends on the system, and it's also the case for ericaceous microheterotrophs as well as the orchids.
Oh, okay.
Pretty similar anatomy, but in the orchids, inside the cell, there's this thing called a peloton, and that's the fungal hyphae. So the orchid draws the fungus in. The fungus goes into the cell and proliferates a hyphal coil.
Okay.
And this is the cool part. It gets digested.
Oh.
So the plant then says, thank you very much, and I'll take that coil. And then basically, you know, it just disintegrates inside the cell.
Wow.
And probably the fungus is losing there, that the plant is then taking all the nutrients, carbon, nitrogen, and anything else.
Right.
And
yeah.
That's kind of, and so in orchids, that's the only interaction that I'm aware of that's happening. In the ericaceous ones, like pine drops and Indian pipe and some of those, there is a hyphal coil, and there does appear to be some sort of loss of that coil, but there's also a Hartig net and a mantle. So it gets a little bit more fuzzy now. It's like, well, okay, so this has evolved twice at least, and in one case it's clearly a parasite. In the other case, we need more studies.
Wow, that's absolutely fascinating. Intriguing that this is a multi-different pathway for evolution here.
Yeah, I think it's every time it evolves, it's got to be a different story.
Kind of its own unique trajectory, right. Like a river would never be the same twice.
Right, right.
Now, you have done work on invasive orchids, or at least the one here in eastern North America, the Epipactis hellebrine orchid. You had mentioned you found some interesting things here regarding truffles. What's going on there?
Well. So it's not just me, but I did have a student in New York sample Epipactis roots, and we've done some. I've collected some, but mostly I just send the students off to do it. Uh-huh. They bring the roots back, and we grind up the roots and extract the DNA. And it's pretty much, is it fair to say this? It's got to be close to exclusively associated with ascomycetes.
Really?
And then primarily associated with truffles. But
really?
There's some other, those would be true truffles, tuber. There's some other ascomycetes that fruit below ground that are truffle-like. And the Epipactis is associating with those as well. But they're not they're not the true truffle. They're just hypogeous ectomycorrhizal ascomycetes. So I think we sampled all over New York, and I'd have to pull those data back up, but I think a good half of the samples we had were with one or multiple truffle species, true truffles, and then another half a variety of different ascomycetes, and nobody really standing out as a more frequent genus than another.
That's interesting, and I wouldn't expect that from such a wide-ranging non-native. I mean, I see this orchid in the city in flower pots. I see it growing up in some of the worst soils in Buffalo, and I find it in some of the more pristine stands of forest here in the Southern Tier. That's really weird that they're so specific.
Yeah, so I think what's going on in a lot of cases, it's not always mycorrhizal.
Mm.
That's one thing. Now, we haven't, you know, ground up every single piece of the root. But a lot of times, not a lot, but often it wasn't mycorrhizal. It would seem to just be living without the mycorrhizae.
Interesting.
But I think the part that I think will help close the loop a little bit is truffles are disturbance-oriented fungi. They do particularly well following disturbance. So when you look at an Epipactis on a trail side, on a roadside, you know, those are great places for truffles.
Right.
For spores especially to be active in those areas, or basically you could stimulate them to germinate and start forming mycorrhizae. So I think part of this sort of ubiquitous nature of this Epipactis is that it is honed in on a group of fungi that are pretty much everywhere and often in disturbed habitats.
Ah, okay. So it makes sense then from that aspect that the thing limiting its growth. Like disturbance.
Evolutionary and ecologically, it's like, boy, that's a great strategy.
Interesting. Now, I mean, that really hints at a lot of things here in that, so like all orchids, the Epipactis is probably most dependent on its mycorrhizal interaction for germination and its early years. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I mean, does this relationship change over time with a lot of orchids, especially some of the mixotrophs, where they start off not photosynthesizing and then eventually moving into a photosynthetic life?
Right. Yeah. I think we don't have enough information on that for me to just say hands down, yes, they all switch. But it does look like the true achlorophilous orchids, those that never do form photosynthetic machinery, pretty much stick with their original host, if you will. And now the fungus is the host.
Nice.
So once that fungus gets into the seed and starts, you know, delivering carbon and the seedling begins to grow underground, if you think about it, those microheterotrophs just put up a flower and die.
Yeah,
they don't really do anything else. So it's always underground. Those don't switch. The green ones quite likely do.
Right.
And you're right, they're completely microheterotrophic, you know, as you know, through the seedling stages until they put up a leaf.
Mm-hmm.
I still think we need more information to know if it's in every case if they're switching to different fungi.
Right.
The green ones aren't necessarily with mycorrhizal fungi. That's one part there.
Really.
So, some of those are with saprotrophic fungi.
Oh, wow. How does that – I mean, obviously there's probably limits to what you can infer, but how does that work, that you go from something that is evolved to kind of have this give-and-take relationship to something saprophytic, which is purely digestive? I mean, is that a different kind of mycorrhizal strategy or –
Oh, well, yes. I don't know. I can't really go – I can't elaborate. I think that – if I'm not mistaken, those green orchids that are associated with the saprotrophs primarily, there's a couple cases where that's not true, but primarily are associated with jelly fungi.
Levisconaceae
and Tulazinaceae, and these are things that are just in the litter.
Yeah.
Occasionally I have found them on ectomycorrhizal root tips also, but they're not very frequent.
Interesting. So it speaks to the need for having a good duff or humus layer.
Yeah.
Supporting those kinds of relationships.
Yep.
So, I mean, the big picture here that you're hinting at is that the distribution of these plants is very much tied and limited to the distribution of their fungi. Maybe not the other way around, but some of your research on a different species, one of those ericaceae, the pine drops, has hinted at that. Do you want to talk about that one a little bit?
Yeah, so that's exactly what we thought is, and what we do think, that if you go out to California, where I did my earlier work, pine drops is quite frequent. And if you just take my old advisor once said you could take a thimbleful of soil, out of the Sierra Nevada and put that into a pot with pine, and he would get the fungus that associates with the Indian pipe on the
wow.
So the spores are really abundant in those soils, and they're long-lived. We have other papers and other labs have shown that these spores of this particular fungus are resistant. They lay down essentially what you might think of as a resistant seed bank, but it's a spore bank.
Interesting.
And so they sit around forever, and eventually the plant seed shows up. And they may be resistant as well, and the interaction eventually they hook up, shall we
yeah.
say. And it's, I think, one species of fungus out west still. There may be two now that they have found, but they're very closely related to each other. That is, of the fungus.
Okay.
And then out west, out here, we found out that, yeah, it's a related species of fungus. It has never been found. The fungus itself, but we cultured it off of root tips of the pine drops and sequenced it and, you know, fit it into the phylogenies and said, yeah, it's related to the same guys out in out west, but it's clearly its own species. And when we do a soil bioassay where, you know, it's clear that a thimbleful doesn't do it around here.
Yeah.
It's much more rare. And so that's what Chris Hazard's paper basically concluded, is that the rarity of the plant, and in New York there used to be, I think they had it in the early 1900s, it was in something like 20 different counties of New York.
Mm-hmm.
It's now limited to Letchworth Park.
Oh, wow.
And when Chris started, we went out there her first season and found old spikes from the previous season.
Yeah.
But then we never saw it during her master's. So she had to go up to Michigan to get most of her work done.
Jeez.
She did some soil bioassays there at Letchworth Park, though, near the campground, and was able to, you know, demonstrate that what we were seeing up in Michigan was happening down here also.
That's really interesting. So I guess, in a way, the strategy really works well in an area that isn't dominated by humans, but, you know, there's some of this rarity maybe tied to land use history, you think, or I don't know how far you can speculate with that.
Oh, I'm willing to speculate a lot on this one. So rhizopogon is a classic resistance, or I should say, it lays down those resistant spores.
Mm-hmm.
Its life history traits really point to a fungus that is a disturbance species.
Okay.
So the area that we found it in, Letchworth Park, had experienced severe flooding, and a lot of the trees had died. I don't know if it was 50 years ago or something that they told us about. And so the pine drops was still there. The fungus was probably not fruiting anymore, but the spores were still there. And then it was on the pines also. Up in Michigan, she found it in sandy areas where they had done logging.
Oh, wow.
And or post-fire. It does really well after fire. And so I think 20 counties in New York is a function of the fact that they had just, you know, logged the bejeebies out of these forests. And so what we're seeing is this fungus still hanging around on regenerating seedlings and even trees for quite a while, but eventually it peters out because, like a good disturbance species, plants are the same way. They can't compete well when the community becomes more climax-oriented.
Interesting.
They drop out, but they've left their spore bank for the next disturbance.
So it's a lie in wait to the perfect moment.
Yep. I think that it used to be very abundant around in New York because of disturbance histories, and we've stopped fires, we've stopped logging, we've, you know, blah, blah, blah.
The typical human response to things.
Yeah.
It's interesting because we're a species that does all really well at disturbing in one kind of way and really poorly at managing disturbance in a more natural setting. So this, I guess, is a really good poster child for that kind of thought process and the way we kind of interact with the wildlife.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it helps. For me, it helps to think of removal of fire in particular is a disturbance.
Yes.
That really throws the system off track. It's been evolving for, you know, thousands, millions of years or whatever with fire, and then we say, yeah, actually, we don't want fire anymore. All those species are geared towards it. So.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that the species is associated with pine, something that, you know, out west, as you said, has experienced far more of a fire regime, so perhaps there's something to be said for that as well.
Yeah, I think, and didn't they, in the Adirondacks, when they would log, they'd burn and have pretty massive fires from the slash to the extent that they had those fire towers, and today you can't start a fire out there.
No, they're very adamant about that.
Well, no, I don't mean just like culturally. I mean it's known as an asbestos forest. It's too wet.
So
once it grew back, you know, without the logging debris, there was no dry timber. There is no fuel. It's not a fire regime type place. I mean, I think the typical fire cycle, natural fire cycle, is probably 500 years or more in the Adirondacks.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely threw things off whack in a few different ways around here.
It's really interesting. So is this disjunction now, like you said, I've seen pine droughts out west. Is this disjunction between, are they found in the Midwest or, you know, in the prairie area? Is it a glacial legacy thing, you think? Are they related?
That's a great question that we kind of grappled with and then dropped. I don't think anybody has done a survey, an adequate survey, up through the boreal forests, say into Canada.
Right.
It very well may currently exist in pockets all the way across to the west, or it may have at one time. And Saskatchewan gets a little sparse with trees, I guess.
A little bit, yeah.
But our assumption was that at one time there was probably a continuous forest or enough of a patchwork that the plant could basically exist across the whole continent, but we don't have any clear evidence of that.
Interesting. All right, I guess my final question might be a multiple parter here, but you had mentioned culturing these fungi in the lab to understand them a little bit better, and how, you know, we've already upset natural disturbance regimes for a lot of these species of fungi. Going forward, is culturing fungi and reintroducing it even feasible? Are these species that, you know, we better start protecting what we have now because it's not within our scope of abilities to do any sort of large-scale restoration for such, you know, especially orchids or pine drops, stuff like that. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, so it depends. The rhizopogon and tuber, those culture pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even a couple of papers from Sheffield that came out in the early 2000s where it was an orchid called Triffida. What's the first name? Coralloriza triffida. And we have that out here also. And it's associated with a fungus that actually we can manipulate in lab a little bit and get it to grow. And what they had done is they had put, first of all, they put seed packets in the old 35 millimeter slide, you know, like you show a slideshow.
So they do have a use still.
Yeah, exactly. And then, they put the seed into a mesh inside those seed packets or inside those 35 millimeter slide frames, and bury them. And then they collected those about. And actually, Chris did that in that.
Right.
The Pteraspora paper, she followed that same method. Well, what they were able to do is they, first of all, they saw a much better response, and they had those seeds, some of them were just packed with little seedlings or protocorms. And they took out individual protocorms and put them into pots with soil with the, I think it's a poplar or may have been a willow that was the green host, and they were able to get the three-way symbiosis running in lab. And what Chris was trying to do was repeat that with pine drops with the notion that she would outplant that three-way system back into Letchworth Park. We didn't quite – it didn't quite work. But I think with some – you know, the right person with the right green thumb, et cetera, I think actually that could work.
Cool.
The problem in general, though, is – so – just looking at Coralloriza, that's an orchid that I don't know if you're familiar with it, but
yeah, quite one a few tattooed different... on my arm actually.
Oh, you do?
Yeah,
that's cool. Okay, so Triphata is greenish, and it's associated with Thalephora, and they will grow in culture. Maculata and Striata have no green parts, and they're symbiotic specifically with Russulas, which we cannot culture.
Bummer.
So, yeah, that's right. So whatever we try to do there, so far to date, that one is perplexing us. We can't get the – and it's one of the most prolific mycorrhizal fungi in our forests.
Wow.
A lot of different species, but you're always going to find those Russulas out there. And,
yeah.
And yet we can't tweak them in lab at all.
Well, it's also interesting that we don't see, you know, maculata being more abundant in that example than
– That's right. It's striata as well. I mean, I'm aware of only one patch around us, and it hasn't flowered for a couple of years. And I initially I was going to do this whole comparison of, you know, the sort of Triphata and ease of reintroduction versus striata and maculata and how hard it'll be. But you can't do it when you don't have the plants.
Yeah, kind of limiting.
Right.
Interesting.
So, in general, like with restoration of the plants, I think it depends on what fungus they've honed in on. And then in, you know, the overall ecosystem and what's out there in the forest, there's so many fungi, and we cannot culture most of them.
Yeah.
We can only culture the disturbance-related ones, like the rhizopogons and the truffles and some of the others. But I think we're fooling ourselves if we think we can come back and restore things.
Right.
And then continue now to just behave as we do. I mean,
yeah. Goes without saying, I guess, to this.
Yeah,
I'm
sure
you're
preaching to the converted here.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of those things that a lot of people aren't even aware of. You know, the below ground stuff is kind of new, I guess, in terms of our ability to understand it. So, you know, I guess going forward with research like yours and finding people that are passionate about it, who knows what the future holds. But until then, it sounds like conserving land as is our best bet.
That certainly makes sense, yeah. And then the other flip side of that is the invasive species problem,
mm-hmm.
where we're sending soils and duff and inoculum all over the planet.
Mm.
And so some of the more recent work that I've got, I'm trying to get the papers posted on my website, but right now I just have the titles for the last couple of years. Work that I've been doing down in Argentina and Chile, pines can't invade. I mean, native pines stop in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
So we planted them all over the southern hemisphere, and now we're seeing that they've become a really massive invasion problem. But they can't do it without their fungi, and they can't utilize fungi that are down there. They have to introduce the fungus host the fungus from the northern hemisphere. And so you could check out those. I mean, I think I'm just putting in the context of we're just learning about the below ground part, and you know how hard it is to restore something in its native setting. And then in some cases we've, you know, pushed it the other direction. The epipactus is an invasive.
Yeah.
Douglas fir and Monterey pine is an invasive in the novel habitat.
Wow.
And so that's a whole other dynamic that we're sorting out. But you can see the citations and follow it if you're interested.
Great. All right. Well, I'll definitely put a link to your website up on my website for the podcast.
Okay.
But I really appreciate you taking the time to do this today. It was fascinating.
Oh, good. Well, again, I appreciate the interest, and obviously always love talking about it.
Great. Well,
and I did surf your website, so I actually added a comment somewhere you can look for. I don't know if you saw it.
I might have replied to that on the Fismia, right?
Oh, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yep.
Cool.
So good. Keep up the good work.
Excellent. Thank you very much, and you're welcome back anytime.
All right. Cheers.
All right. Yep, cheers.
That was awesome, wasn't it? That was really great of Dr. Horton to take time out of his research. It just goes to show you that there's still a lot of unanswered questions out there. As always, I appreciate you listening to this podcast. If you enjoy it, please consider giving it a review on whatever podcatcher you got it from. It really helps spread the word. Also, there are plenty of In Defense of Plants stickers in stock, so make sure to head over to indefenseofplants.com/shop to pick up some for you and your friends. Have a great week.